Okay, bon, je vais faire un petit. Hello everyone. So today we have Aurélien Mordret, who is a seismologist. So you got your PhD at IPGP, I think, and then did several postdocs, and now you are at the GEOS in Denmark.
Yeah.
So he will present us his latest work.
So thank you for having me. So I wanted to present one of the latest work that I am working with Adolfo Gushin, is a colleague and friend who's a theoretical physicist, quantum physicist, and with whom I'm collaborating on this weird object. I'll try to explain you how ties to seismology and earth science in general. So the outline, the main motivations. I spent, I think, maybe two-thirds of the presentation just doing an introduction to different kind of field, because it's pretty new still for me, so it's good to keep all the ideas together and the main applications in the end. It's going to be short, but I hope it's going to be inspiring. So the main motivation is using seismic network. I'm working with seismic arrays and network a lot. And most of them, when you install them, if you don't feel work, you know that you cannot install all seismometers exactly where you're supposed to plan it. But most of the network, you design them for a specific purpose, either for doing detection, so you could do beamforming or array analysis, and usually you will try to maximize. I don't know if I have a pointer. Yeah, I found the ones in. So when you want to do a beamforming or array analysis, you want to cover evenly all the azimuths and ranges to really sample the wave field properly. So this kind of design in a kind of spiral or star shape are pretty well designed for that, but they are not very good to for imaging purposes. For imaging purposes, we mostly lay out a regular grid of sensors when we can. But the problem with those regular grids is they can suffer from what we call the beamforming, aliasing, spatial aliasing. So I think maybe everybody is very familiar with spatial aliasing here, so I will go very quickly. This was a presentation for non-seismologists originally. These are like four examples of aliasing. Here it's a temporal aliasing when you record with the camera something in motion, and when the frame rate of the camera is not fast enough to capture all the motion, you can end up with a weird effect, like the wheel that goes backward, a chopper that doesn't turn, or a bird that doesn't flap its wings, because he actually flapping his wing exactly in sync with the frame rate of the camera. And so the main principle of aliasing is you record a signal on a regular array. Actually, when you have a physical signal, you only see this signal at a specific point, those ones. And when you try to analyze it, you interpolate, you can do measurements, estimate a velocity, for example. Here we are in space, but we can be in time. And you see that we can reconstruct the signal. But if we have a much shorter period signal, same thing, we are only measuring it at a specific point. And here we see that clearly we have what we call cycle skipping, where we see only those points, which are completely different in terms of period. We have apparent periods. So apparent velocity, we completely misinterpret the signals that we are measuring, which is completely different from the true signal that crossed the array. So that's aliasing. And the criterion that we have to fulfill based on the Nyquist theorem is to have at least two measurement points per wavelength on the signal to fully recover these signals. When we perform beamforming using a regular array, we end up with this kind of figure, where here, for example, I sent a plane wave coming from northwest with a 2 kilometer per second velocity, and we see that on this slowness diagram, we have a bright spot at 45 degrees northwest, and the distance from the center gives you the velocity of this plane wave. That's all well when we are not aliased, but when we are aliased, if I send the same plane wave with a smaller wavelength, we end up with this kind of figure with a repetition of this this bright spot all over the place. And in this case, it's difficult or impossible to know which one is the real one. The shape and the position, the amplitude of these side lobes are completely controlled by the geometry of the arrays. So if you go from a square array to a triangular array, you see that the side lobes are placed differently. Here we have a hexagonal pattern again. And if we have a purely regular array, those side lobes are identical to the main lobe, and so it's very hard to decipher them. So the main question, can we find an optimal design for seismic arrays where we have the side lobes that have a very small amplitude, that are as far away as possible from the center of this image, so they can go beyond the border of the image of the beamforming, so we don't mix them up with the main lobe. And the bonus would be a design that could be good for beamforming and imaging. And this is where we go for the tiling definitions. So I want to just analyze the seismic arrays as tilings. So tiling is just the covering of a plane by different geometrical shapes, without overlap or without gaps. There are different types of tiling. We can go for the simplest one, which are the periodic tilings, where all the patterns are repeating by translation, but not rotation nor reflection. And mathematically speaking, there are only 17 ways to perform the periodic tiling, no more, no less. And all those tilings, they only have a 2, 3, 4, or 6-fold rotational symmetry. So this is also how the crystallographers and mineralogists understand what a crystal is. It's a pattern where the atoms are repeating exactly with these patterns and with exactly those rotational symmetries. A monotile, the last definition, is a polygon that can pave the whole plan periodically or aperiodically. For example, those triangle, equilateral triangle, a square, or an hexagon are monotile that are periodic monotile, because there is no way to arrange them on the plane to have nothing else but a periodic pattern. When we go to a bit more complicated stuff, we have also non-periodic tilings. Those are tilings that don't have any translational symmetry, but for which the different tiles that we can use to build them can also make, if we arrange them differently, a periodic tiling. This is the example on top, where we have two rhombi, one a thin one and a thick one, that can make a periodic pattern, but also this Penrose tiling, a very famous non-periodic tiling, that's also made of those two tiles. And then the last case, the most extreme one, is the aperiodic tiling. So here it's where you cover the plane only aperiodically, and there is no way to arrange the tiles, so you will be able to make a periodic tiling with those tiles. This is one example with a Robinson tiling. So why those aperiodic tilings are interesting and worth studying? It's because they have a strong links with what we call quasi-crystals. They are state of matter that had been discovered in 1984 by Shertman, who in this lab managed to draw a crystal that didn't have the 2, 3, 4, or 6-fold symmetry, had a 5-fold symmetry, and was not supposed to exist in nature. Actually, the chemistry Nobel Prize Pauling, you are seeing after this discovery, but didn't believe actually that such a thing existed, and say like there is no such thing as a quasi crystal, only quasi scientist. 2011, Shertman won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for quasi crystals. And this is an example of a quasi crystal that's been grown in lab, just by arranging molecules of monoxide, carbon monoxide, and we see how it makes this nice pattern. and actually, quasicrystal have been found recently in nature, so it's not only in a lab that you can grow them. First one in a meteorite, and the second one in a mineral that's called trinitite, that had been created by the first nuclear explosion, the Trinity test explosion in Nevada, where it melted the sand and some wires around the installation, and in this mineral they found quasicrystals. And the last example, the most recent one, is from a fossil lightning bolt impact on the sand dune. Also, so you see that those quasi crystals, they need some kind of impact force to be created in nature. And it's still an ongoing research to try to find more in nature. So back to this quasi crystals. Studying aperiodic tying is actually an extremely good model for quasi crystals. You see this non-periodic Penrose tying is really overlapping extremely well on this quasi crystal. So using this mathematical model to study the nature of this arrangement is pretty useful. Just a bit of history of aperiodic tiling, how it started. Started in the 60s with a mathematician called Wang, who was working with this kind of tiles, and conjectured that, say, if a set of tiles can cover the plane aperiodically, it also must cover it periodically. So he was conjecturing that there is non true aperiodic tiling, only non-periodic tiling from the definition before. Five years later, his own PhD student probably wrong. He found that actually a set of more than 20,000 tiles that you could use and arrange to cover the whole tile, so a repetition of this 20,000 set, that could tie the plane purely aperiodically without making it possible to make it periodic. In 2015, with the same set of tiles, John DeLorel reduced the number of tiles to 11. And so that's how the race to find the least number of tiles to make aperiodic tiling really started in the 60s. Robinson in 71 found 6 tiles with weird shapes and weird arrangements to make sure that you arrange them properly, that could pave the plan only aperiodically. Then Penrose, this is a famous tiling, just a bit killed the game, found 2 tiles and 2 different type of tiling that could pave the plane aperiodically. And then for quite a long time, that was it. Only 2 tiles, and the question was, is there like a mono tile that could do the same job to pave the plane aperiodically? Gumelt in 96. Find a triangle that could maybe do it, just a single tile. But actually, when you look carefully, you had to make those tiles overlap, those little triangles. So yeah, you have the yellow one, the blue one, and the green one is actually overlapping with the yellow one. So it's not a properly periodic tiling or aperiodic tiling or tiling at all. Mathematicians say you cannot overlap tiles. Then we had the group Schmidt-Conway-Danzer, who found a 3D tile that could pave the whole volume aperiodically. That's not exactly what we are looking for. So we are working in 2D. Then we had Scholar and Taylor. We found this style that could paint the plane aperiodically. It's a bit complicated. It's not actually a time because it's disjoint, so not the right properties. And finally, March 2023, this group of mathematicians found one tile called the hat because of its shape that could pave the plan purely aperiodically, and there was no way to rearrange them to pave it periodically. And some people will get very angry by this new discovery, say that actually to really pave the plane, you need this tile and its mirrored image, the blue one. So they are a bit picky, so I'd say it's not really the right tiling. Okay, this same group of mathematicians 2 months later found another tile that was associated to the first one, and this one, so the called the specter, because it looks like a ghost. If you curve the side of each side of the specter with curved curved side, you can actually show that you can pave the plan purely aperiodically, and it's a unique tile. So it's really the an aperiodic monotile. So the whole problem started 60 years ago, was finally solved last May in 2023. And the question is, makes the headlines of many newspapers. There are 2 papers in preprint for the moment. The beauty in this story is that the discoverer of this tile is actually not a mathematician, he's just an amateur, a retired print engineer who just happened to play, like to play with tiles and knew the problem and just cracked the code. So pretty impressive. And so they found those 2 tiles, but what they found is actually it's a whole family of tiles. There is an infinite number of tiles that are controlled by one parameter P, and they call this tile P family. So we see on this animation all those tiles moving this P factor between 0 and 1. Make this a nice mesmerizing pattern. So don't look at it too much, otherwise it will be simple. So all those tiles, they have 14 sides, 14 sides and vertices with lengths P or 1 minus P, and with constant angles. So we have the hat with a parameter P equal 1 over 1 plus square root of 3. The specter is the equilateral tile with all the sides equal lengths. The turtle is the symmetric of the hat on the spectrum. And the two extreme tiles that are don't have the 14 sided, but just some lengths are equal to 0, but we won't analyze them this way. So the question is, can we use those tiles as geometry for seismic arrays? If we put seismic station at each vertices of those tiles, what kind of array do we are we constructing? So for that, I looked at different properties, especially the response function of these arrays, which is just the special Fourier transform of the location of those points, which can also be seen as the beamforming results if a plane wave is coming directly from below the array with the infinite velocity. So here is an array response for hexagonal lattice regular array, and you see that you have those spots with that are repeating all over the place with this hexagonal array. Yeah, here it's in a normalized wave number domain. We are normalized by the minimum interstation distance in this array, so that all the network of the arrays are comparable in this figure. So for the hat, this is the array response, not so different from a natural regular array. You see also those spots with the hexagonal pattern. For the turtle, the same thing, but just rotated sideways. So basically, it's more or less the same array as an hexagonal regular array. But if you look at the spectre, the array response is completely different. Here, instead of having a six-fold symmetry with hexagonal pattern, we have a almost 12-fold symmetry. If you count the number of points here, you have a dodecagon here. But the main point, the interesting point, is that those bright spots, actually, compared to the hat, the turtle or regular arrays, are quite far away from the center. The main bright spot, the first one, are at a wave number equal of 2, and almost and the main ones are at 4. So they are very far away from the center, which is a good property for an array, because you don't have those side lobes that are that can get in the way for beamforming. So why the hat and the turtle are actually so close to a regular array? Because they are sharing most of their sites with a hexagonal lattice. And so half of the points on the hat is actually falling on the hexagons. And so that's why you find that this pattern back on this array response function. Whereas the spectre is actually placed more or less randomly, and you can find only three sites that could overlap with the hexagonal array. So it's much more irregular in terms of shape, even though they are built with a very in a very similar manner and have very similar shapes. So those are three examples for p's, but we have an infinity of p-value between 0 and 1. So what I analyzed is all these values, and instead of looking at array response function as a 2D image, I integrate them radially along the wave numbers. So I was just looking for where the maxima in the radial distance in K are placed for all the different P's, all the different factors. So this is for the regular hexagonal pattern. And this image shows, so the vertical axis is the wave number K, so it's the radius of this image. And the horizontal axis is the different p values for the different the whole family of tiles, and the amplitude shows where the maxima are located along k. So if we look at the hat response, it's located at p equal 0.37, and we see that we have a main first peak around here, which is this peak that located a bit above 1 meter per meter. And then you have all this repetition. And those red lines are actually the location of the peak from a regular hexagonal lattice. And so you see that you intercept those maxima. Actually, at each position of the line, you will have a maxima in this diagram. Because the hat is very similar to hexagonal lattice. The same for the turtle on the other side of the spectrum, you find the same maxima. And what you can also notice is that there are like some broad range of higher amplitudes along K that are falling exactly on the hexagonal lattice energy. So you have interferences and between the hexagonal lattice, which is somehow always in the background of those aperiodic tiles, except at the center around the p equal 0.5, where we have the spectre tile. And the good thing is that we see much more clearly that for the short wave number, actually there is no maximum compared to the other tiles. The first maximum is actually around the number approach, and the second one is around 4. It's actually good properties for beamforming. Another way to look at that is to compare this array response function with another type of geometry, this arrangement of polygon like squares and triangles. And if you take the array response function of this geometry, you find this this pattern that is actually pretty similar to the spectre the spectre pattern, and we see that the maxima of this top figure are in purple here, and that's where we find the maxima also of the spectre. Not all of them, but some of them are actually overlapping. And the reason why is that if you rearrange those shapes, you can actually almost make a spectre. So rearranging this very regular array like that can make a twisted spectre shape, and that's why the two responses are so similar. So those are just spectral description of the arrays, but if we go directly for beamforming, those are those five different arrays, and again I send a plane wave coming from northwest at 2 kilometers per second, and at the aliasing limit of each array, what you see is that for the regular array we are aliased as expected, so it's very hard to find where is the true maxima. The true maximum for the hat and the turtle array, the same, but for the spectre we have a clear unique maximum that shows that it's a good design to truly identify those waves. The square triangle array, something intermediate, where we have a clear maximum but we have side lobes that are quite strong. So when we look at all the whole family of Tai P, and look at beamforming here, I use the beamforming with an illumination, homogeneous illumination of wave from all directions. So from the beamforming point of view, we don't expect one bright spot, but a ring of energy at the center. And to assess the quality of this response, I measure the signal to noise ratio in this image, with my signal being the inner energy of the energy of this ring divided by the energy of this outer ring. And what we see on this figure is that the signal to noise ratio as a function of the P factor is quite high, around 2, but for this central part around the spectre parameter, we have a clear maximum in the signal to noise ratio, so we have a higher resolution for this range of parameter around the spectrum. And we have also a clear minima for the hat, which is here, and for the turtle, which is here. So those two first ties that have been discovered at first are actually the worst one to try to do beamforming with. And the last one, the spectre, is one of the best for doing beamforming. So this is at the aliasing limit. So we have set the wavelength at just twice the interstation distance. But now if we just fix the arrays, look only at the spectre array, hexagonal array, the square triangle array, and the regular square array, and we move, we change the wavelengths. And here is the wavelength divided by the minimum interstation distance. So at 2, we are the Nyquist limit, the aliasing limit. We see that we have this maximum for the spectre array. So we have a hyper resolution at the Nyquist frequency for the spectre. And above here, it's the normal range of use of seismic arrays. We see that we have a main peaks around the 3.5 wavelength, so it's actually pretty interesting. And I never realized that most of the arrays, when they use the above the Nyquist distance, have a main response around the 3.5 wavelengths. But in general, the spectre tile behave much better than any other tiling that we try so far. So here it's only one tile, 14 stations, so it's pretty underwhelming. Let's try if we go with a much larger large N arrays. So the first problem that we had is like how do we design seismic arrays that have N stations with the specific geometry. So we had to write convert the codes from the mathematicians to make them a bit more user friendly. So now we have a code that if you draw any polygons on Google Earth, you can send it to our codes and choose the number of stations you want to put inside this polygon, and you will exit directly with a map of the tiling with the array geometry. So far we coded only those three tilings, and it's not only tile 05 but all tile P family. But we can make array design very very quickly with this different type of geometries. And if we use big arrays like that, for example 300 station to do beamforming, those are the results for distributed noise sources or plane wave all around the arrays. And again, with the spectre array, we have a much better signal to noise ratio in this image, this beamforming image, compared to the square triangle, which has a lot of repetition and large amplitude in the back. The Penrose tiling also is not very good. So in terms of signal to noise ratio, it's lower than most of the Tile P family. And this is just the reference with the regular array with a SNR of around one. So we see that the spectre again is good, but there are other P factor or P values that that are not too bad or even better, but we still need to explore. Same example, even more obvious with a single plane wave. When you do beamforming with the spectre array, there is no aliasing, it's just one single maximum. You have killed all the other side lobes, which is true for also for the square triangle geometry, but less drastic. The Penrose styling is also not too bad, but still you have some local maxima that can be mistaken with the true one. And here is again the curve of the signal to noise ratio. So here it's a different signal to noise ratio, just the ratio of the maximum inside the little red circle divided by the maximum outside of it, so anywhere in the image. So you see that when you are at one, that means there is at least another maximum elsewhere in the image. And you see that you have actually 11 P values that produce a second maxima in the image. So you have some aliasing effect, but you have also a range of P values with sharp peaks where the secondary maxima is at least twice lower than the main one. So, in terms of analysis, it's more or less everything that I wanted to show you today. But the big question is like, why does it work so well? Because we end up with a geometry that's what it is, and it's still puzzling to me in the end. That's why it works so well. I think the main explanation goes for how we can quantify the numbers of degrees of freedom available through these geometries. And one way to look at that is to look at the distribution of interstation distances and azimuths. Here it's a probability distribution for a regular hexagonal array. In terms of azimuths, you see that you have a spike in the distribution because you oversample some azimuths and the neighboring azimuths are actually undersampled. This is the distribution for the interstation distances. See, you also have gaps in this distribution where there are some distances that are never sampled. So you have some blind spots in this image. For the square triangle and Penrose array, it's a bit better. The distribution are a bit smoother and flatter, but you still oversample or undersample some azimuths and distances. Whereas for the spectre, you have at least in azimuth, you have a distribution that's really, really, really flat. That means with this particular geometry, it's not very obvious. You actually sample all the azimuths almost evenly, perfectly, each of them without any gap or any redundancy. The same for the distance distribution. It's also very smooth. There is no gap in this sampling. And that's why it's so efficient, because there is you maximize the quantity of information that you're able to sample with this kind of geometry. So that's also why I claim it's good for imaging, because if you want to do, for example, ambient noise tomography, you will draw a straight rays or rays between stations, and you don't want to have a redundant information. If you have a rays that are covering the same area over and over again, actually you don't really add that much information. Here, all the rays are more or less unique and will sample parts of the medium more evenly. So I think it's also a very good geometry for imaging. And the bonus is that also a good way to do a compressed sensing, because to achieve the same resolution with this this array, you need one third less station than for a regular array. Also in terms of cost to go in the field, it's pretty important. But we found that actually aperiodicity is not the criteria, that the necessary condition for this kind of geometry. We have to explore different parameters. And actually, there is an infinite number of aperiodic tiling with this type P family, but only a few of them are actually good for beamforming and seismic imaging. So it was quite fast, but it's good. So in conclusion, try to harness a new mathematical discovery, a very recent one from last year, to have a direct application in seismology in seismic array processing. We found that some tiles and some geometry in this big family of aperiodic tiling actually very well behaved for beamforming and imaging applications. Requires fewer stations than the regular arrays. And that should also be pretty ideal if you want to do match field processing, where you also can suffer from cycle skipping and aliasing. And the big question now is, we have these geometries, where else can it be applied in seismology or even beyond? Just a flavor from my friend and colleagues working with electrons on this a weird lattice, that they found that depending on the magnetic field applied to this artificial medium, there are some moments where you see like those tiles are actually lighting up. It's all the electrons that get trapped around some tiles, and so the material behave as a pure insulator. But for other magnetic field values, you have electrons running around the whole materials. You have a pure conductor. So just if we were able to design those material for real, we would be able, just by tuning the magnetic field we apply to it, from a pure insulator to a pure conductor, and I guess it would have many cool applications in many different fields. And another thing that we are trying to understand is that if we use this kind of geometry, for example, for designing a wind farm location, can we also maximize the output of the wind farm to avoid those wake effects? This effect that when you have two windmills side by side or one behind another, the second windmill is actually in the shadow of the first one and doesn't receive as much wind as the first one. So if they are not aligned, if we can use this geometry to just shift them in space, can we actually improve the efficiency of wind farms? And on this note, I'm done.
You try to put the stations randomly.
So yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, if you constrain the minimum and maximum interstation distance, then random adjustment can be better than those geometry. But they are random, so if you want to redesign 1 month later the same array because it was so nice and everything, there is no way to do that again. Yeah, you can record, you can save that, but here it's completely fixed. You have an algorithm to design this geometry. It's completely deterministic. So I think it's an advantage if you want to play around. Or if you want to scale things, it's pretty easy.
So when you say it can be better, it can be worse.
Yeah, by chance it can also be worse if you if you really do a random throw, you can end up with a geometry that, that doesn't perform as well as statistically speaking, you will do better. I think in the end, if you do 1,000 or a million trial with this geometry, you do it once and you know it's good from scratch.
It depends on the number of stations. Huh? If you have a low number of stations, it's better to have your geometry than the random sample of the space.
I don't think so. And here we are limited by the smallest number, which is 14, which is maybe not the best case. I think it's works better for if you have like 100 stations. But I don't think there is a relation with the number of stations, because when you normalize everything, when you do the beamforming analysis, if you want to compare like apples and apples, you want to have the arrays that have more or less the same statistics in terms of minimum interstation distance and maximum aperture. Otherwise, you can always find a random throw with fewer number of stations that for this particular case will work better, but it's not guaranteed that the next throw will actually be better or worse. So that's my concern with those random design. They can be better. They will be statistically better, but you are not sure if it's always be better.
But you can also play on your random field by trying to maximize
After
the homogeneity of the
exactly after
Fourier distribution, not only uncorrelated, but really.
Yeah, it's true. Here we didn't try to optimize the design. We have a fixed design and we try to assess which one is the most appropriate. But then I guess it could be a good starting point if you want to even adapt here you can really play with the misfit function and try to optimize the location of the stations. Actually I did some tests. If you randomize just a little bit the position of the station around their true location based on percentage of the interstation, the minimum interstation distance, in the end if you put enough perturbation, a random array, regular array, or the spectral array will behave exactly the same in the end, and actually better than their fixed behavior. That's partially due to the fact that you reduce the average interstation distance by doing so, but also because you smooth and you randomize the location and you flatten the distribution of interstation distance and azimuth.
Why do you get a peak at when do you get a peak of the signal to noise ratio at lambda over R minimum, which is around 3.5 to 4? But why is this peak compared? Does that mean that if you put twice, so if you use an R minimum, which is for the specter, R minimum, which is two times smaller than lambda, it's actually R, or two times smaller than lambda over two, we get something better.
Not sure. Here, just
why do you get two peaks? You get
two peaks.
You get one at Nyquist frequency,
yep.
And another one at where you have put. Distance between station, which is twice large.
the wavelength that is that's three you have 3.5 station per wavelength.
Basically. Okay, that's 3.5
stations,
and in the other one it was 2.
Yeah. So, like this peak is the normal peak for when you do a ray analysis. It's usually it's in this range of wavelengths that that people are working and are assuming based on Nyquist that an array should behave properly because you don't have aliasing or anything in this range. So it's around. And the question, like 3.5, why at 3.5 most of the arrays are the best response rather than 4 or 5, but that I'm not completely sure. I haven't really investigated that. It's often cited as a rule of thumb that this is the case, but I think it's one of the first time I see some curves that are actually showing that for different type of arrays.
But my question then is why it's at fixed number of stations, right?
Or yeah, it's
otherwise, but if you would have
yeah, exactly.
as many stations as you want,
here
you
it's,
expect that when you
here it's,
when you oversample and put more in
exactly,
stations,
exactly.
You increase your signal.
Now here it's really when I take 14 stations, like those arrays. And I'm changing the wavelengths of the wave, so it's a fixed geometry, fixed number of station. But yeah, I should redo this figure actually for different geometries to see if we have the same spike at the same wavelengths.
So what did you do for your next week,
So was discussing with Florent Jambert actually yesterday. He wants to try the Spectre Array on his Greenland ERC project because it's a nice place on the glacier to install those arrays because you don't have a tree or a rock that get in your way. So you can really design the array properly. So we are going to try that. I'd like to try also this this geometry, but it's going to be much harder on the Massive project in the Massive Central with the sorry at the beginning. Yeah, with the nodal array here, it's a regular grid, but I'm changing this geometry and having a Spectre array instead. Yeah, it's going to be more complicated because you have forest, you have roads, so maybe that's not the best application, but I think for glacier or desertic area, that's pretty good. You can really put your sensor wherever you want. But yeah.
Don't forget your GPS.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. There is no way then to just install it without GPS. you need to have the pointer in your GPS.
You have to be cautious with email communications. Talk about installing the Spectre array in
yeah.
North Atlantic.
Yeah.
all James Bond movies there.
Clark. Yeah, the mathematician they came with these names. They don't want to call it the Ghost, right? They prefer to call it the Spectre. It's James Bond fanatics.
And you say that you have got to make a polygon and poker earth, and it's already like in public use or?
And if you ask me, I can give you the Jupyter notebook after you are finishing writing the paper, so it's going to be attached to the paper once it's published, so it will be on GitHub. So no problem. So the first step is to go on Google Earth and just click on Google Earth to design your polygon where you want to install the station. It can be anything. And as for the moment, it has to be on the same UTM tile. So it doesn't cross border between UTM tiles. So I didn't have time to code that. But otherwise, you would be able to design whatever array within a polygon.
You are planning to try to make a practical experiments in Copenhagen or in
but maybe because you can be it can be deployed like for on a very small area just to study for example like urban noise it's pretty easy on the football stadium football field could put like 100 sensors this this design the first plan and the first client is is Jean-Bert in Greenland so I'll see if I manage to install something before to have a real real case experiment.
And in Folscan, they did that one?
Folscan, yeah. Yeah, we did the stars and yeah, this regular grid. Yeah, I think the star shape should be on Iris, actually, the data, if you want to play with that.
And how many sensors do you have here?
Here, so on the top figure, it's 300, and in the spiral array, I think it was 150 or... Yeah, 150. Yeah, Folscan is the project of Florent Bringuet, that's the project to monitor the different faults in California. So this this array, we deploy it close to Ridgecrest. So just at the epicenter of Ridgecrest earthquake, and this array is near the San Jacinto Fault in Southern California.
For the train.
Yeah, yeah, we have like trains passing in the valley behind, and we can listen to them. But when we, it's like I designed those two arrays, and it always bothered me that regular arrays are limiting factors that when you plan them for like low frequency things, but actually you found out that the trends are high frequency and you are biased and you say, damn it, if we had a different design that's more versatile. And so that's why I started to think about this kind of
journey. Switch to this.
Yeah. Before the data, do you recommend to follow the tile?
That's I was thinking about that, like to not the Spectre tile. I don't know if it would have the same property, but then you have to project your wave field along the DAS to do beamforming with DAS it's kind of tricky.
Are there any arrays which are designed to be multispectral by with the fractal properties of the density
That are already installed, I don't think so. And something that we wanted to do in Massive to have like this multi-scale approach, but very rough. It was not like designed geometrically, just put a smaller array and a bigger one.
Yeah, you can use that a certain number of times.
You need
to make something scale-free
The
maximum.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was the idea. I don't know if we didn't compute all the scales to be sure that we were like covering all scales. But the idea behind that was very stuff. Those spiral things they actually cover a huge range of scale because the arrangement of the stations along each bench is like logarithmically increasing. So you the smallest interstation distance, maybe 2 meters, and the largest is 100 meter on the neighboring station. Then you have the aperture that is 2 kilometers. So you can cover a huge range of wavelengths. So,
and if you make a fractal design, it's considered as a
fractal is aperiodic.
You get both. You get deterministic fractals and non-deterministic fractals, so that depends what you want. But the simplest one in pedagogy, like the Sierpinski cascade or these things like that, they are periodic. You take a triangle, you remove the central triangle, you redo the same thing. But you can do the same with random, with no regular array.
It's hard to
network in so sometimes you have a denser part.
I mean, at small scale there are like some imbricated triangles or either like a small triangle and then a larger one rotated by a irrational number and a larger one and so on. So you make like circles like that where you can also cover many different scales. there is no good resolution, but look at all the points in this this big tiling. You see some it looks fractal also by design. I got just an excuse to make nice figures and beautiful colors.
But then you would have no excuse if you have that data.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. Should be able to detect everything with that. Un puzzle avec des...
Moi, j'avais
des trucs comme ça. Et taille. Oui, bah oui, tu peux faire des volumes et tout ça.
Je
pense
que c'est
une bonne idée. C'est la semaine, il y a des trucs qui, en fait, c'est pas enregistré sur les professeurs d'université.
Enregistrement.